Loud.
Would you like to come and stall it?
Ah, will you just stall it, look?
I'd like to come and stall it.
I'm not really in the mood.
Well, come on and bleed and stall it.
Yeah, house hatcher.
I'm not a house hatcher.
We'll stall it for the crack. We're gonna have a laugh.
Episode 5 of the Manson series. You're welcome back. Do you like how I spread that out? It was really nice, wasn't it? Like,
very smooth.
Pretty what?
Smooth.
Yeah, it was smooth.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued. You have me hooked.
You sound happy. Your stomach hooked, anyway.
No, I know. I'm too long. My body is too long. That's my theory. I have way more intestines than most people. So it's
you
just like,
definitely have an extra one.
I think so.
Yeah.
So, most people have a large intestine and a small intestine.
You've
I have
got
a medium as well.
Yeah.
Difficult intestine.
Jesus Christ.
Does it keep you up at night?
I have 6 stomachs, I think.
It's all that spicy food you're eating.
You're professionally eating spicy food these days.
Yeah, my stomach is not happy.
No.
And oh, my stomach is just going, oh.
I won't ever do that again.
It's just moaning. It's moaning.
Oh, yeah, I'll leave it. It's basically crying out for you to stop giving it chilies.
Mm. I'm not eating chilies.
Anyway, I was Charles Manson doing the big weird bastard.
Well, I need to start off with a correction. To a correction, because the fact checkers have come for me.
Brilliant.
Yes, I love it.
I knew you were wrong.
That out there. And that all came
I just
for
didn't
you.
Want to say to you.
About what?
All of it.
The whole thing.
Didn't even happen. It's a film. It's
yeah.
A plot of a film.
Speaking of films, so Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The fact checkers have come for me.
I only watched that recently, so I'll tell you. Where were you wrong? And I'll tell you.
You didn't say shit when I said this. So
I didn't watch it again before then.
Well, did you say that he walked up the driveway or something? But in reality, he was just down standing at the gate. Is that what it was?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Nothing that precise. I said Adam Driver played Tex Watson. I was dead wrong.
Oh, you were.
And why didn't you say it at the time?
It was fella played Elvis.
Austin Butler. Yep. I just got it completely wrong.
I can see how you got that mistaken.
He could have played Tex Watson.
Oh, he could have.
I think he would have been the second option. For sure.
He was probably working on Star Wars at the time.
I feel like you're patronising me now for this mistake, and you two didn't pick up on this at all. So we're all as guilty as each other here.
It's a long old recording, you know. If you say Adam Driver's Tex Watson, we'll probably just fly over our heads.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in that film. And so I watch it once and I don't care for it. And he could have been in it and it would have been like fine with it. Yeah, go on.
Anyway.
Correction made.
The first time I watched that, I didn't even know who Tex Watson was.
We got a few emails. People pointing out my correction.
So there's more?
No, that's the one. That's the one. We're on solid ground with the rest of it.
A few emails making that correction.
People keeping a close eye on me.
Wow.
That's what you want, to keep you honest.
Yeah.
Well, at least you're honest and you held your hands up and corrected it.
You have to own your mistakes. Right, so, in the last episode.
We're getting into the meat,
the investigation side of things. Yeah. Murray?
Yep.
And how's it going? How's this shambles of an investigation going?
Well, last episode, we talked a bit about the somewhat blinkered view the detectives were taking. So even when the detectives investigating the Gary Hinman murder were coming along and saying, this looks very like something that we're investigating.
Yeah.
They were going, nah, that wasn't the only mistake they were going to make from the very outset. So if you go back to the crime scene on Cielo Drive, the morning after they find Sharon Tate and the others killed. So the place is, as you'd imagine, swarming with police officers. This is kind of the start of a trend of them making a mess of things. Instead of kind of carefully preserving the crime scene, there's just police officers walking in and out. And what would you imagine there was a lot of in that house?
Blood.
Yes.
Just fucking footprints all over.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
At least one police officer, maybe more, like was leaving their footprints going in there in the house in blood.
It's just unhygienic, if nothing else. Like, imagine just walking around in blood.
Yeah.
Dirt.
There was a gun found at the scene, someone accidentally, or the handle of the gun, someone accidentally kicked it under the couch.
The handle?
It was the handle of the gun was found, like bits of the handle, because it broke as Hex was hitting Wojciech Frykowski over the head with it.
Must have been some smack.
Oh. There was the glasses that were found. Somebody decided it was a good idea to take them off the floor and put them on top of a desk. So there's other detectives coming back and going, who's moving the evidence around the place? And who's walking blood in and out of the room?
The crime scene, for fuck's sake.
Here's one example of how they just were not doing a very good job. So a news reporter for ABC.
Not the alphabet.
So this was after, I think before the trial. It was before the trial, but it was after Susan Atkins had given testimony, which she'd eventually do. And he says, well, we know they had to have driven up this road that goes through the canyon. They changed their clothes after this bloodbath and then threw them out the window. And he said, if you were to do that, where would they be? Somewhere alongside the road. So he said, how would you figure that out? So he gets in the car with someone else. He says, right, drive you up the road there. And he takes off his clothes and throws them out the window and goes, right, how long did that take me? Say, a couple of minutes. And says, right, well, let's drive a couple of minutes up the road.
This reporter was doing this?
Yeah, he was trying to work through it in his head.
Taking into account the published report in the Los Angeles Times, the story that Susan Atkins told about what allegedly happened that night after the murder at the Tate House, we drove from Cielo Drive at the base of Benedict Canyon up here. Leaving from Cielo Drive, driving up Benedict Canyon, we timed ourselves and tried to place ourselves in the same position that the people would have been in that night after they left the Tate House. 6 minutes and 20 seconds of moderate driving up Benedict Canyon led us to this spot. And looking over the edge of this hill, we found several pairs of blue jeans and what appeared to be some very dark sweatshirts. These shirts and the blue jeans appear to have stains on them. So without hesitation, I called Lieutenant Robert Helder, LAPD Homicide, and told him that I think we have found the clothes they're looking for. This is where we found it. It's right down there.
We'll go down and take a look at it. Well, we found some trousers and some shirts. Appeared to be turtleneck shirts or something, dark in color.
Did they appear to have any stains on them, or are you permitted to make that determination?
I made no observation as far as stains.
Any other things or objects located down there?
No.
If objects like this were to be bloodstained and have been down there for that length of time, would the scientific lab be able to determine whether or not there were these kind of stains on the articles of clothing after being out for so long a period of time?
I don't know. I'm no expert.
How did you get word about this this afternoon?
We were notified by my boss, Lieutenant Robert Helder, who received a phone call from what I believe is Channel 7 News.
He knows he's getting sacked in the morning.
Yeah, he's gone.
He knows. He's like, fuck. He has to go back to his wife and say, hey, darling.
Yeah, we gone.
I lost my job. I forgot about the clothes down in the valley.
Yeah, so that was reporter Al Wyman. With the ABC, the local ABC TV station. And but the police still hadn't taken what she said and used it to figure out where the clothes were.
Mm.
So that's kind of what you're dealing with.
And what, they just didn't care?
No, they were like, oh yeah, no, we'll take them in and have a look.
Check the DNA.
Better have a look.
Wow. If they had it back then, it would work.
The guards were bleeding useless. Just going on, that was back in the day where they used to just go on hunches. Yeah. I've got a hunch.
September 1st, so a few weeks after.
My birthday.
As a 10-year-old called Stephen Weiss, he found the gun that was used. He found it dumped. So he takes it to the LAPD.
And they blamed it on him.
Yeah.
Did they?
It was you.
Lazy bastard. Yeah, you're getting done for it, man. Get in the jail there, open it yourself, here's the keys.
They get the gun. And they go, oh, thanks for that. And whoever took it, they just put it on the shelf somewhere.
God, what are you doing?
And they never, like, it took absolutely ages for them to figure out that this was the gun. Nobody checked. It was just sitting on a shelf in some police station somewhere. No, like, whoever took it in didn't think to say, anyone looking for a gun that might have been used? Before the murders, it seems a few people had actually gone to different police forces and warned them about the Manson family. Everyone from people in the music industry, the bikers, some of the bikers, people who just generally came across them had said to the police, like,
They're odd.
They're odd, and they kind of seem violent, and they talk about kind of mad, violent stuff. And the police visited Spahn Ranch a few times. This was not the first time Manson or the Manson family came up on their radar.
Yeah.
Another bit of pretty bad police work. Remember the glasses that were left, and Polanski thought Bruce Lee had done it because Bruce Lee was missing his glasses?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine Bruce Lee doing that. For fuck's sake, like.
So the police obviously had them from the very first day. But about 2 months later, they called a press conference to announce they had found glasses related to the crime. And they sent flyers on those glasses to 18,000, or they sent to the optometrists, like associations around America, and it reached 18,000 eye doctors all over America to see if anyone knew who owned the prescription. But this was 2 months after they found them.
But they didn't. They just left them there just for the sake of leaving them there, did they?
They just, I don't know, they just had them and didn't do anything with them. They had, I don't know. The big failing, though, is that the police just don't talk to each other. So it's the really obvious one that we mentioned already, which is the Gary Hinman detectives, who worked for the LA Sheriff. So it's a completely different police department to the LAPD. The LAPD did spot similarities. You can go back and see, like, there's newspaper archives, and the headline is, like, the LaBianca killings are exactly the same as Tate. Like, it wasn't like they completely missed it. And there's an anonymous quote. It was attributed to a detective who says, oh yeah, they're carbon copy crimes of each other. So some people were spotting it and going...
What's all the ignorance to it about?
Well, they essentially thought that Tate killings must be something to do with drugs. And the LaBianca killings, they thought the most likely reason that they were so similar is they thought it was either a copycat, maybe a burglary, someone staged it. Back then, I'm not sure if it's still the same, but back then 90% of murders were committed by someone who knew the victim. So that was the primary thing they were looking through. And the LaBiancas and everyone in Sharon Tate's house, there was absolutely no connection between them. So they're going,
they're not looking.
Highly likely it's someone they knew. They don't know any of the same people.
Mm.
It's a coincidence or a copycat or something else. On August 12th, so only a couple of days later, they came out and said, like, we're treating these two crimes as unconnected.
They couldn't be more connected. It's mad.
In Helter Skelter, the book by the prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi, like, he goes in a detailed breakdown of how many times the LAPD, particularly, so there's two detective teams, obviously one for each, particularly the Tate murders. They didn't just drop the ball. It was like they didn't even realise they were holding the ball.
But were they just stupid? Like, I feel like even looking at that video of that detective just seems incompetent and stupid. Like, he'd be sacked today. Be like, he's not able for this job. Why is he how is he the best police officer in the LAPD?
I think they just had it really easy up until that point.
I think he was just fuming.
Yeah,
that fella's just pissed off that he's been the one sent to go on TV.
Not only getting the boot.
I don't know. I feel like it was the 60s. Everyone was being sent to war. It was the draft, and it was like the last remaining people qualified to take these positions. Like, they were just incompetent.
The Tate detectives, one thing that probably led them not to take seriously, there was things the Gary Hinman detective mentioned some theory about hippies. Once they heard hippies, they went, absolutely no way hippies did this. So forget any link to Gary Hinman. But they did have suspects pretty early on, because they found out that recently enough, there had been a party at the house, and Roman Polanski had kicked out three people because they got into a row with other guests. Those three people, it turned out, were drug dealers. And so that also fed into the idea that someone had come back, someone in the drugs trade had come back and done something, exacted revenge. The tip-off for that went to the police from two members of the Mamas and Papas.
Two members of... Oh, what, the band? I thought you were going to say Lots of Papas. I thought it was good to do with Lots of Papas, right?
The Mamas and Papas.
What song, what did I sing again?
California Dreamin'.
Oh,
California Dreamin'.
That song just reminds me of Serial Killers.
Yeah.
It's used a lot, isn't it?
It's all tangled up in this now.
Yeah.
Stay up.
It's a great show.
How were they connected?
They were at the
party at Tate's house, and later on they were talking to the police and said, these three drug dealers were kicked out by Roman Polanski. Now, some of it's down to incompetence, but kind of the accepted explanation for all this is just the different police departments were not very good at communicating with each other. Even the squads of detectives working on the two murders within the LAPD were no good at talking to each other, and nobody checked notes for a very long time. It seemed a lot of it was down to just pride and rivalry between the two teams. They worked in the same room. They each had a desk a few feet from across from each other. and they just wouldn't talk to each other. So the Tate detectives were the old school detectives. They didn't believe in any of your fancy modern stuff. They were like, ah, you trust your gut and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, smoking on the crime scene and all.
Ah, yeah, walking in and out.
Ah, you look good, kid.
So they're doing their thing, and the younger squad are on the LaBianca case, who it seems they were much more on the ball. There was also some bitterness because when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated the year before.
He's not coming into it now, is he?
Don't worry, only briefly. But these two, like these, I'm guessing these were the two best murder squads they had. The younger crowd got the Bobby Kennedy gig and the older crowd were pissed off about that.
Ah, the whippersnappers get the Bobby Kennedy gig, huh?
Ah,
we get
the new guys, ah.
So they just did not talk to each other. They didn't like each other.
Real petty shit, yeah. Isn't it?
that it came down to stuff that simple.
Wow. They sacrificed them being right, like.
Yeah.
No, he wanted the Bobby Kennedy gig.
Because they didn't like them.
Even when the LaBianca team were much better, it seems, and they were the ones who really cracked it, and they had suspects, including Charles Manson, a while before they were arrested, they started wondering.
So who got the LaBianca one then?
They were the younger crowd.
The younger one again?
No, that's the LaBianca one are the younger team.
Oh,
the Tate murders.
Someone got the Bobby Kennedy gig. Who got the Bobby Kennedy gig?
The LaBianca team.
The LaBianca team?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, they're the hot shots.
They're the big ones.
Yeah.
They're the ones solving the crime.
The best in the business.
Doesn't seem like it.
I don't know. The Tate seems bigger than the LaBianca.
Yeah.
So it's like Bobby Kennedy down to LaBianca.
Would that not have like soothed their bitterness over Bobby that they got out of the two here, they got the big one?
Yeah, it's like throwing them a bone. Hey, you can have the Sharon Tate one. Yeah, second best, whatever. It's still better than LaBianca.
Anyway, they didn't get over it, it seems. They're very, very pissed off. They would move things on and just not tell the other one.
Did Bobby Beausoleil not just come out and just rat on Manson if he lived?
No.
Okay.
No.
Why? He's no rat.
Bobby was no rat. He wasn't very good under questioning, but he was no rat. A few days later, back at Spawn Ranch, Manson family have gone back to Spawn Ranch. August 15th. Do you remember the Straight Satans, the bikers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bikers with day jobs. Their man, Danny DiCarlo, he was their treasurer and he was the main man who was with...
They were their treasurer. It makes him sound so official.
And he was with the Manson family and he was kind of living with them at this stage. But he had gone on to the rest of them and like, lads, they won't let me leave. I know too much about what's happened and Charlie won't let me go. So the Straight Satans show up at the ranch and say, you have to let him go. And at first Manson kind of plays nice. He's like, oh, come on in, do some drugs, you know, whatever.
Like it's a cup of tea or something. Come in, sure. Do a bit of LSD there.
And sleep with the women.
Oh.
He offered that to everyone who showed up.
Of course.
They were holding firm, saying, no, Danny's coming back with us when we leave. He's like, right, well, there's loads of snipers hiding on the ranch and they're watching you. And when I tell them they're going to shoot you. This is all bullshit. Well, we presume. And the Straight Satans, seemingly part-time tough guys, they said, okay, fair. They legged it. But then the next day, the LA County Sheriff does this massive raid on Spawn Ranch. Huge. Possibly the biggest one in the history of the Sheriff's
Ranch.
Definitely the biggest raid in the history of the ranch. Maybe the biggest in the history of this police department. They arrest Manson and 25 others, but it's all based on that they're suspected of being involved in an auto theft ring. So just stealing cars. They were stealing a lot of cars to make into dune buggies for, you know, coming apocalypse.
Mm.
Police show up and they find all these stolen cars, the 26 of the family who were there, and they find weapons. All this stuff. Like, it was a big deal. They're very pleased with themselves. Then a few days later, they were all let go with no charges because someone had misdated the search warrant.
They're very incompetent.
Well, Joe, I don't mind telling you, we're going to be coming back to some of this stuff when we talk about doubts on the story.
Great.
Some people raise things like this and go, that's strange. Manson, even though they're not charged, first of all, they get out and he goes, right, we're going to Barker Ranch now. Where Barker Ranch is the place in Death Valley.
Woof.
Hole in the ground.
The hole in the ground place.
Woof Ranch?
Yes.
Nice.
Barking.
Yeah.
Nice, nice.
Good.
Yep.
And he says, we're going out there. This is it. Enough is enough. Manson was still furious.
Who went though?
They were going to go. The whole family were going to go out to Barker Ranch. Right. They had been going back and forth a bit and staying out there at times, but now was the time for the full move. Manson thought someone must have snitched on them for the raid. So there was this fella who worked as a ranch hand, Donald Shorty Shea. Manson suspected him. They'd always had trouble, these two. First of all, Manson didn't like him because Shorty was married to a black woman called Magdalene, And when she would bring over her friends and family, a lot of whom were also black, to the ranch, Manson would be disgusted. Remember, massive racist. They'd also had run-ins short. He had beaten Manson up once because Manson had
beaten
up the wife of another of the ranch hands. And it was all this stuff. And then Bruce Davis, Tex Watson, and Steve Grogan, kind of three of Manson's main heavies, they take Shorty and they take him down a hill near the ranch and they kill him. This is just a couple of weeks after. But this will become an open question for a long time. His body wasn't found for 8 years.
Jesus.
Wow.
Yeah. And for like, even at the later trial, people were asking like, well, what about that missing ranch hand who
wouldn't tell them?
Manson was not a fan of. Yeah. After Shorty Shea, then that is the point where they're out of there. Off to Barker Ranch.
Wow.
Thank you.
Into the hole in the ground, in the desert.
Exactly. So just to jump back a bit on Barker Ranch, we talked about this a couple of times, particularly in the first episode. Barker Ranch was the real remote place out in Death Valley, middle of nowhere. The way they found Barker Ranch, though.
On a stroll.
Well, almost. There was a woman called Catherine Gillis. She would become one of the family and one of Manson's like most loyal devotees. But they met her because her boyfriend was a sound engineer who worked with the Manson family when they were doing those recording sessions. And she was just fascinated by the family and their music. She went for a drive with Charles Manson. And while they were out on the drive, she told him, oh, my granny has a place way out in Death Valley in the desert that you might want. Manson, I presume, had told her like some of his vision for the family.
She knew just the place.
Yeah, she knew just the place. But she comes back from the drive. It was a half hour drive. And she tells her boyfriend, I've just met Jesus Christ and I'm going away with him.
That quick?
That's it. We're moving to the desert.
That's
the
way it was words.
Very influential.
They move out to the desert and at first like loads of the family liked it. They felt like pioneers. Manson paid the owner of the ranch, Arlene Barker was her name. She owned the ranch, so he paid her with a Beach Boys gold record.
And that's you take it?
What do you mean a gold record?
Yeah, you know, like the presentation gold records. Dennis Wilson had given him one as a present.
Okay, right.
So Manson paid his rent for however long with the Beach Boys gold record.
And she was just like, happy days, big fan of them, yeah, give us that so. Why are people just getting in the car for half an hour like and he's saying mad shit and they're just like, I met Jesus Christ.
I know.
Like, you'd be just like, will you fuck off?
Imagine convincing someone in half an hour because he read that book.
If I was in the car with him and he was like, blah, 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 have all these plans. And by the way, I'm Jesus Christ, I'd say, jump and roll. Gone, covered in sand.
In the desert.
Yeah, it wasn't actually Barker Ranch that Catherine Gillis, that her granny owned. It was Myers Ranch, but that was basically another ranch very, very close by. Manson loved Barker Ranch so much, he's like, oh, this is perfect for us.
This is the one in the desert, Joshua Tree, yeah?
Not Joshua Tree, but yeah, Death Valley, similar.
Okay.
Like the absolute middle of nowhere.
Right.
Like you're on the moon, nothing grows there.
Is that ranch open still? Like, is that...
I think they've knocked down the buildings now.
But will people go to it because of its history?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, there's loads of videos on YouTube of people doing like explorations around it and stuff. And it was searched many times for bodies.
What were they living in the ranch? Was it just like...
Just these cabins.
Cabins.
Like a wooden cabin with one... There was a few cabins. I think only one of them had running water.
I don't know why, when you're talking about it, just picture like a cave or something.
They lived in caves too, I think.
Yeah, is it?
Some of them would sleep in caves.
Last night I watched a documentary about this Mormon guy who had loads of wives.
Mm-hmm.
It's a documentary from 2002, but it feels like it's from the 80s. And it's illegal. So basically he moved out into the desert.
Why do you watch so much reality TV about wives?
Well, this is a documentary. Because it's a weird world, like, you know, fucking polygamy and all that shit.
But variations on the theme of marriage just fascinate you.
Yeah, well, it is kind of fascinating. It is sort of fascinating. But just that one man has this sort of influence out. It's essentially a cult. Like, polygamy is essentially a cult, especially if it's on a religious basis like Mormonism. Then it's like literally a cult.
Mormon's a cult?
But it's a religion, but like if you go, if they had to move out into the desert as well, and they were living in trailers and stuff like that, and dark shit. Mm. He was marrying like 14-year-olds. He married a 14-year-old girl who then later on, he ended up getting arrested because it turned out that she was actually only 13 when he married her. But then he married her ma. And then, like, it's just there's so much fucking, like, he married sisters and it's fucked up shit. It's a mad documentary. It's a mad person. And he was on, like, Jerry Springer, and he was on a lot of reality TV at the time. Before, this was before TLC. So
it was normal, like?
Yeah, like Judge Judy. He was on Judge Judy.
Why did I never hear this fella? I watched a lot of fucking Judge Judy.
He's dead now. But it's a mad fucking story. It's a crazy story. Crazy person. Crazy lifestyle.
Exactly like this fella.
It kind of feels, but that's what you were saying. Like, where is it? And he was living out in the desert in the middle of nowhere, just in trailers.
All these sickos, they just like relocate to the desert.
It's a handy
place. That happened over here, but there's no deserts.
No.
Can't go to a desert and say, I'm going to fucking go to a fucking ranch. Like,
yeah. No barren land here.
If there was, like, the likes of the Larry Murphys of the world would be at them. Living there and all. Probably, I don't know. Ranchy, I don't know. Do you just all seem to do that? I'm just saying there's no ranches in Ireland, so you can't do it.
Yeah.
Aren't we lucky?
Yeah, thank God there's no fucking ranches.
Ranches are snakes.
It'd be easier to catch, wouldn't they, if there was?
Ranch.
Where is fucking Larry? Is in the ranch? Of course he is.
So the Myers Ranch, that was the one that the granny owned. But Manson loves it so much, he's like, I don't want to take a chance that we might get kicked off Barker Ranch. I don't know how long a Beach Boys gold album gets.
Right? Only one of them. Can't offer it to someone else.
Exactly. So at what stage that good credit runs out, we just get out of here. We need a backup plan. So what we do is, Catherine, you're going to inherit Myers Ranch when your granny dies. She's like, yep. Right. So will we kill her?
Ah, no.
Fuck off.
And Catherine says, yeah, let's do it.
Fucking hell. Like,
now, There may be more detail to this. There may be other versions of this. But the one I've read is they were all gung-ho. They were like, right, let's go and do it. Started driving off to kill the granny. They got a flat tire on the way over. And it seems they just left it. They couldn't do it that day and they just never got back around to it.
So they never whacked her?
No, maybe because they were arrested first. But yeah.
So before they got there, they were done for all of this?
Yeah.
Flat tire because there was about 15 of them in the bleeding car.
Getting milkshakes, the fucking saps.
At one point, Manson got lost in the desert. I think this was actually long before he moved all of them out there permanently, but he spent 40 hours on his own in the desert. He met a miner who was out there probably looking for gold or uranium or whatever.
I would tell you meant a child.
And that's why, I knew
you think you clarified that.
Yeah,
mining,
This fella told him all about the legends of Death Valley. He said, oh, people disappear here. Because there's a hole in the ground. Brilliant. A bottomless pit. And Manson's like, interesting. Mm. Interesting you should say that. Aliens also come out of this bottomless pit. That was another one he heard.
Oh, yeah.
Some people thought it was a passageway to another world.
Mm.
Manson would tell his followers, once we're in the bottomless pit, you'll turn into fairies and elves.
That's fun, if you want. That's a nice story to tell them, isn't it?
If you want.
And they used to do these dances at night. Like when they're having the sermons, playing the White Album, doing dances. He was like, become the elves and all this.
Hold on, the fucking Bobby Brown.
That's the bleeding LSD, that, isn't it?
Later on, some of the family would say, we knew this was all a bit of a game, you know. And others were like, no, we were going out in teams looking for the hole. Nobody was pretending this was a game. Nobody at the time thought. So some people say, we knew it was a bit of panto.
Did anyone just like come to their senses and say, I'm going to leg it?
Interesting you should ask that. We'll get there in a second. That's very important.
Like, but a runaway, you know, just saying.
Yes.
Let's ditch.
And also the hole led to the City of Gold.
Hot, is it? One of the...
Kinda. There was a few things went against them. Things started falling apart.
They're falling apart as if you ever had it together.
Now, do you remember in the very first episode we talked about how some of the family burned this big earth mover, the big digger, and the police are up investigating that because it's a very expensive digger. They're looking around and they come across these two prospectors driving around, and they get talking to them. The prospectors say, well, there is this one strange group down there at Barker Ranch, and they think their leader is Jesus, and so on and so forth. And that's what then eventually leads to them watching, to arranging the raid and all that stuff that would eventually lead to them getting caught. That prospector, one of them, the main one, his name was Paul Crockett. He was a part-time prospector. He had been a Scientologist.
Only part-time.
He may have gone full-time at this stage, but he did start it as a hobby. get a bit extra cash on the side. He was a Scientologist as well, but he had left Church of Scientology. He was out looking for gold, came across Barker Ranch. There was just two of them who had been left there. The rest had gone off. Been 3 months since these two had heard from the rest of the family. And they were left there on their own, and they were in a bad way. The family were like, we'll be back in a while. They left these two there.
Where's Jesus gone?
Yeah, basically. Crockett gets there and he's like, I'm going to use your cabin here to stay in while I'm looking for gold and all this. And at first they're like, no, you can't stay. This is our place. And Crockett's like, no, I'm going to stay. He wasn't scared of them. They're like, oh, Charlie's going to come back. And he's like, okay. He gets talking to them and he hears their story and he sees the state they're in mentally and physically. And he's like, these kids are completely brainwashed. So he sets about deprogramming them. And it went pretty well.
Mm. This gold miner, Crockett.
Paul Crockett, part-time prospector, part-time deprogrammer.
Starts deprogramming.
Now, he was deprogramming, but he also kind of had his own little cult going.
The prospector.
So there's one of the family. Yeah, one of the family, Brooks Poston, who was working. He was the one that Crockett found at the ranch, and he brought him back to full health and all this. And he completely changed his mind and brought him away from Manson. Manson gets word of this anyway. He's like, what? What's going on out there in the desert? Does someone taking away my family members? So he comes out and he confronts Crockett. And Poston's like, they basically had like a guru standoff.
What's a guru standoff?
Dance of the gurus is actually what he said.
Who said that?
Brooks Poston.
He was in the middle.
He was in the middle. Yeah.
Clowns to the left of me.
Yeah.
Joker to the right.
Manson was like, at first he's like, hey, listen, Crockett, come join me. There's a race war coming. You want to be on our side? And Crockett's like, yeah, no, I'm not buying that. That's all bollocks. That Manson asked one of the family members, Juan Flynn. He said, Juan, go over there and kill Paul Crockett for me, will you? Juan went over and ended up joining Crockett's crew.
Jesus.
Class.
It was going bad. But this is well before the murders, when this stuff is happening.
Early days.
But it's signs that it's a few months. It's signs that cracks are starting to appear. Some of them were kind of getting sick of Manson's thing. Some of them, obviously, some of them were not.
I
want
to shave my armpits for fuck's sake.
I'm a uni, bro.
We'll come back now a few months later, kind of more where we are presently in our timeline, kind of a few months after the murders and so on. The family members, they'd all moved out full time to Death Valley. Like, they'd left their all contact with family, friends, anyone else, all that was gone. They were completely isolated. They relied on Manson, or so they thought, for absolutely everything. They needed him to survive. And it's all about dune buggies and prep for the apocalypse and finding the bottomless pit. That's what it's all about there. And Manson is telling them, if anyone tries to leave, I will send the rest of the family out to catch you, and we will kill you when we catch you. He's not relying on Dale Carnegie techniques to just gently keep them there.
Threatening them now.
Now it's pure, you're not allowed out. You can't go anywhere. So some serious disillusionment kicks in for a few of them around this point. At this stage, we're in October 69, a couple of months after murders, the police still have nothing. The police investigating the Tate murders have absolutely nothing. But the LaBianca detectives did at last spot a connection. They were like, oh, Helter Skelter. They wrote that in the fridge. Isn't that a song from the Beatles album? Took them a couple of months.
Took a while, yeah.
They got there. They got on to
John Lennon.
So the Tate and LaBianca teams were working separately. The LaBianca team got on to the sheriff's office. They were like, do you have anything similar to this? You know, horrendous, blood on the walls, writing on the walls. Yeah, we told you 2 months ago. Gary Hinman, exact same thing. The LaBianca crowd are going, oh, that's interesting. So at this stage, the pieces, they're kind of starting to fall into place now. But the police, obviously, they're still not fully there. And of course, you know, of course, the two detective teams, Tate and LaBianca, still not talking to each other. But then the big turning point is, remember, very start of the first episode, the big digger that was burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
And the police out in Death Valley see this and do a bit of digging.
Hello, comedian. Get up on the stage there. Do a bit of digging. Huh?
That was brilliant.
Yeah, this fella.
Yeah, whoa.
If I say Barker Ranch, there's a very good chance he's going to do the sound of a dog.
Woof, woof.
So,
well, I won't now that you said it.
But it would have been good. And the fact that you two have it on.
So I'm not sure who is setting a lower standard here.
Right. This is some highbrow comedy.
Right, so at Barker Ranch, they watch these weird hippies they've been told about. And anyway, that leads to the raid, which is we talked about all in the first episode. So that's a couple of months after the murders. We're in October here. There is a few versions of the timeline of this, but it makes more sense the way I'm going to tell you. It does add up better. As the police go to do that raid, their dawn raid.
The dawn raid?
Dawn raid.
Is that what they called it?
Yep.
Pretty cool.
They're driving out to Barker Ranch, way out in the desert, early in the morning, dawn, obviously. And on the drive there, they find these two young women, barefoot, just wandering in the middle of nowhere. They pick them up. And it turns out these were two members of the Manson family who, in the middle of the night, had decided they were going to flee from Barker Ranch. They'd basically become completely disillusioned. Charles Manson had been treating them very poorly. I mean, he'd been treating everyone poorly, but these two in particular. And they decided to make a run for it. One was 17-year-old Kitty Lutzinger. They sneak out in the middle of the night. They leave their shoes behind because they don't want to leave. They're so scared of being tracked. They walk barefoot. They walk for hours. They walk up like this high ground and they're gone a little while and suddenly they see all the headlights light up and all the dune buggies coming. They know Charlie has sent them out. He's realised they're gone. And other family members actually would say later, like, yeah, you know, if we'd found them, we would have killed them.
Wow.
So anyway, the police pick up these two women. One of them, Kitty Lutzinger, she wants to tell the police everything she knows about the family. And this is kind of the key break. While the police are back at the ranch to round up all the family, they arrest a lot of them, bring them into jail. These are the local police, so they're in jail in Death Valley. Kitty Lutzinger, she's telling the police what she knows. And she says she heard Susan Atkins had something to do with this Gary Hinman murder. So while the rest of the family are held in the local jail, the local police, they call the LA Sheriff Office and say, well, we've heard something about this murder, this Gary Hinman murder. We have someone here in our jail, Susan Atkins, you might want to talk to. LA Sheriff's Office head out, take her back to their jail in LA. So this is the point where Susan Atkins, who was involved in all the murders, she was the real nasty piece of work. She's then taken off away from the rest of the family on her own. And she's put
for questioning.
Yeah, and she's held
because
on a murder
the two that were leaving, ratted her out.
Yeah.
Just
her, because she was the one they had heard talking about it.
So they're not all aware that this is happening?
No, it wasn't common knowledge among the family about exactly what had happened. Some of them knew what was going on, some of them didn't. Like someone like Kitty Lutzinger, who Charles Manson didn't really like. Someone who's going to run away, like they're unlikely to be in the inner circle, I suppose. Susan Atkins, she's stuck in a cell with few other women who've been arrested. One is Ronnie Howard, the other Virginia Graham. Atkins is going on and on about how the police are so stupid and they'll never find the people who killed Sharon Tate.
We talked about this, didn't we?
Yeah.
This is the moment that it all unravels. She says, oh, we did it. I did it. And they're like, okay.
Why was she doing that?
She's an idiot.
Just boasting.
She's an evil idiot.
I'd like to fucking see what she's like. Like, I'd like to see what her personality is like. You know what I mean? She must be just like a looper.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
When you're reading about Susan Atkins' confession or her boasting, she's all hyper. She's childlike. They're telling her to keep her voice down. They're going, people are going to hear what you're saying here in the jail. She gave them a list of people the Manson family were going to go after. It included Elizabeth Taylor, Tom Jones, Richard Burton, Frank Sinatra, and Steve McQueen.
And that's a legit thing, like,
well, this is what
assumptions is, just take her word for it. Like,
I don't know, she seems off her rocker.
It's a serious hit list.
Steve McQueen, he keeps popping up.
Wouldn't be escaping from that.
Hey. She also told,
no lackey, no lighty. I don't know why I did that.
She also told one of the women in the jail who she was confessing to, she said, of the murders, you have to have a real love in your heart to do this for people.
Well, you would, wouldn't you?
You'd want to be some head case.
Yeah.
Another one of how shoddily this was all handled. So, Ronnie Howard, who's one of the women Susan Atkins told, she goes to one of the deputies who works in the jail and says, she's after telling me all this stuff. So this deputy goes, okay, I'm going to talk to my supervisor about this. She goes on, a Sergeant Broom, was her name. She goes on and talks on to her superior. She says, oh, Ronnie over there was saying Susan Atkins said they did all this. And she seemed to mishear some of Ronnie's story. She said, oh, Ronnie says Susan told her they cut the baby out of Sharon Tate. The supervisor says, everyone knows that didn't happen. So this is a load of bollocks. Don't bother me with this again.
How did he mishear that?
That was it then. They had no more interest in hearing about this.
Well, once she said that, like, there was like, whatever.
Sergeant Broom, who passed this on and all this, and anyway, she was going out with
Sergeant Broom just wanted to sweep her under the carpet.
Huh?
It's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. You have to do the fingers, though.
Pew, pew. No lag. No lag. Doom. Doom, 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 doom.
What a show.
Guess who Sergeant Broom's boyfriend was, or what his job was?
Mr. Pan. Was he a cleaner? I don't know, because her fucking name is Broom. I thought it's like...
It's relevant to what we're talking about in the broader context.
Oh, okay.
Should we guess correctly?
Have a guess. Who would benefit most from hearing that information? Who would you be most... If someone came and told you, I heard something about this murder case, who would you be most likely to, you know, just over a casual conversation in the evening at home, who would you tell it to?
Me, Mrs.
Her boyfriend was one of the detectives on the Tate case.
Ah. Okay, yeah, right. Yeah, but that's wow.
Yeah. Somehow it didn't get passed on again.
Still didn't get picked up on that.
This is the kind of stuff when we get into conspiracy theory land.
I'm excited.
So then Ronnie Howard, who Susan Atkins told all about this in jail, she gets brought to court for her court case. She gets one phone call while she's waiting for her court appearance, and she calls the Beverly Hills, or the Hollywood. She calls the Hollywood Police Department.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the reporter. The Hollywood reporter. I've got a big scoop for you.
She calls him and she tells them. It's only then she calls him at her, from like the public payphone at her court appearance, that it gets out. They almost, again, someone was told what had been done and just didn't pick up on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And she took a shot in the stairwell. Dirty, dirty bastard.
Yeah. Sick like.
So, two police officers come and question her specifically about Sharon Tate, and they were convinced. They said at this point, yeah, we know what's going on here, because Susan Atkins knew details about the crimes. She had been telling them that nobody else would know.
And did she spill the beans on herself?
She did.
Couldn't keep her mouth shut.
She couldn't. She couldn't.
Susan Atkins.
Like, did she not... did she not care, like...
She reminds me of Marv from Home Alone. That's the Wet Bandits. W-E-T. She's spelling it out for them. Yeah. That's Helter Skelter. Jesus Christ, Susie.
Yeah, and after that, so they've got Kitty Lutzinger, who's giving them loads of info. Susan Atkins is now singing like a canary. Then they say, we need to talk to these straight Satans, these bikers. So they go and talk to them.
The fake bikers.
The fake bikers. Dun, dun. And the straight Satans were all talk. They said, one of them said, oh yeah, no, I remember Charles Manson telling me about killing 5 people and writing on a fridge in blood. They're like, oh, that sounds relevant. And then they talk, he said, but you'd want to talk to Danny DiCarlo, our treasurer. He was spending a lot of time with him. They go and talk to him, and DiCarlo, if you remember, we mentioned, he came from a family of gunsmiths. He knew his guns. And he told them, actually, yeah, Manson had a favourite gun. And strangely, it disappeared from the ranch the weekend of the murders. And he said, I can draw you an exact picture of it now, because I know guns so well. Exactly what it looks like. They took the picture and they went, oh, this is that gun that kid handed in.
Jesus. I think it's funny that he says, I can draw you a picture.
Yeah, little doodle. Maybe they asked him. At this point, they kind of know who they're looking for. They find prints, or they match prints from Tex Watson and Patricia Krenwinkel with prints found at Sharon Tate's house. This is staggered, but it's over the space of a couple minutes. At the end of 69, they're like, okay.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had 3 of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and 6 others. Those arrested are 2 women and 1 man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. 5 women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family. They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs. The family left the caves they'd been living in on the Spawn movie ranch in the early fall, after the Tate murders. The family set up another camp in the desert, near Death Valley. Five members are now in jail on other charges in the desert town of Independence. The family's leader, Charles Manson, is jailed here. It is expected that he will be charged in the Tate murders. Police apparently got their break in the Tate case when this girl, Susan Atkins, a member of Manson's family, was arrested in another Los Angeles murder and talked to a cellmate about the Tate killings.
And when did he find the shite on the stairs?
Mm.
When did they... the equation?
How do we know about the shite in the stairs?
That's what I want to know.
Who told about that?
Did she just say... Was that... Oh, by the way, you're on that.
In court? Bag of poo?
I don't think it was ever recovered.
Imagine exhibit A, a bag of shit.
Well, in the next episode, we're going to hear about the court case, which was actually probably... It was more ridiculous than if someone had walked in and paraded around a bag of shit.
Really?
The maddest court case
really
you've ever heard of.
Oh, Judge Judy.
It's Charles Manson, the showman, directing his cast of characters to make absolute chaos from the family to his...
Just make it difficult for
his lawyers. And he had a lot of lawyers. He went through a lot of lawyers. One of whom did not make it to the end of the trial.
Because he died?
He did die.
Was he murdered?
Well.
Oh, shit.
The last thing anyone said to him was, Manson said, I don't want to see you in this court again. And he never came back to that courtroom. Manson was against Vince Bugliosi, the prosecutor.
So many names, isn't it?
Yeah.
So many
names. Bugliosi is the fellow who wrote Helter Skelter. Remember we talked about him?
Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah. It was just like so many different names.
And he was a showman in his own right. So it was two showmen going up against each other.
Did the other gorilla turn up?
Paul Crockett? I don't know. No, I think...
I thought he'd have rocked up in the suit like in
gold. Gold suit.
So yeah, the trial is madness. Right, so... Next, the trial.
Yes.
Right?
That sounds fun. That sounds like we can have a bit of fun with that.
Well, sure, I suppose we'll leave it there. We'll leave it there, so. But there's more on the way.
We'll leave it there. Probably next. Just like Susan left our shite on a step.
Yeah.
Huh? She did do that.
Frank
Maybe she just said that. Maybe she thought, do you know what would be cool? If I said, no, I took a shit on a step, don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit.
Has your dog shit on the carpet, yeah?
Yeah.
Melting it. I needed to buy a carpet cleaner just for that.
Okay, we wrap this up.
So what I'm trying to say is the Manson family should have got a carpet cleaner to cover up the poo as exhibit in the next year, exhibit A in the next one.
You're giving a lot of weight to this lump of shite, Dan.
Poo is funny though, isn't it?
Like he used
like
to be
poo. Poo for thaw.
Thanks very much for listening.
Right, and before we finish up, just thanks to Oran O'Halloran, who helped out with the research on this one.
Absolute legend, yeah.
Mm-hmm, he is.
Really clever bloke.
Yep. Say goodbye.
So, see you later.